Hello, and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Sarah DeFellin.
Hello.
In the middle of the first international break of the season. Yes, it's finally here, everyone. We can all relax. All the mess of the transfer window has gone. That's all forgotten. The chaos of the opening weeks, that's gone as well. Now we've got the nice, gentle international window. Oh, it's great, isn't it? Yeah, nice and sedate, isn't it? It's nothing to get too excited or worked up about, isn't it? That's what it should be, shouldn't it?
Well, it's definitely nothing to get excited about. I think you've got that dead right. I did catch up with a few friends and we said, oh, let's watch the England match. And it was on in the background and it still was sucking the life out of the room. it was so dull. But I mean, to be fair, I'm not a fan of international football outside of tournaments. And especially when you've got a relatively successful and dare I say, large side like England against minnows, if you like Andorra. It's never going to be the most competitive game, is it? It was a bit of a snore fest, but then again, it could have been 4-0, and I probably would have thought it was a snore fest just because it's a qualifier, you know?
Yeah, I watched the majority of the... Well, I didn't watch the majority of the game. It was on in the pub which I was in, which most people were actually watching the women's rugby, the England versus Australia match. That's what the commentary was in the pub I was in. But then I was in a pub that had most of the people who just spilled out of the Arsenal WSL match. So there was a crowd there that was going to be more interested in the Red Roses match. Terry, you were in Germany, weren't you?
I was.
Did you see any of the England game or did you see any international football while you were away? Or were you just having too much of a good time?
No, I mean, I went to catch up with a couple of friends. We did go to a football match, but we didn't have anything to do with the international game. And no, I mean, we were on our way back from lunch when the England game was starting. So, I mean, albeit a late lunch, but if you take my meaning. So, I mean, we're all three English guys, three England fans, but none of us felt sufficiently moved to watch it. I mean, against Andorra, we just didn't think it was going to be worthwhile. And we were right.
Yes, yes, yes. You were right. Yes, England won. No surprises there. And the smooth progress towards the World Cup continues. There's just no jeopardy in it, really, for England fans, which I suppose you want as little jeopardy as possible in qualifying, but it doesn't really get the blood pumping, does it, Terry?
No, it doesn't. And I think that it's to the detriment of the competition because not long ago, actually, I say not long ago, it has been a while now, the idea of qualification jeopardy for England is a pretty outdated concept. Part of that is because England are now much, much better than they were. But the other part of that is because the competition expansion has meant that high-ranking teams like England, like Germany, I was about to say Italy, but that's the exception proving the rule, Spain, France, you know, I mean, unless they really catastrophically get it wrong, like Italy, you know, they're going to qualify for these tournaments. And they don't really have to put much in. And it does take away the peril of it. And so therefore, it means as a spectacle, you're less inclined to worry about it. I will watch Serbia versus England tomorrow, but that's possibly because I'm quite interested to see Serbia play, really, more than anything else. Not so much interested in the England side of things, although I will obviously be supporting, you know, England. It makes me wonder whether or not there is some value, given how easy it is for the top-ranking teams to qualify, whether or not there is some value in them not participating in the qualifying tournaments and just getting selected based on their rankings.
What would they do instead, though? So would they just play meaningless friendlies?
Well, I guess to an extent, yes. I think you're talking about meaningless friendlies. I mean, I guess you can make an effort to make these meaningless friendlies a bit more meaningful. And of course, they will have the Nations League as well, not occupying those slots in the calendar, admittedly. Or you could use it as an opportunity to repurpose the Nations League, I suppose, and do it that way. Because it just feels to me as though these competitions are... This is going to sound arrogant, isn't it, I suppose?
Yes.
Like, I was watching Germany versus Northern Ireland yesterday when I got back from Germany. And Germany really did have to work very, very hard. But they won in the end, and they kind of always were going to win on the end. And Germany have been poor, but they are going to qualify. And you're just sitting there thinking, well, this is all a bit pointless, isn't it? Can we not do something different with our time than this? And so I do wonder whether or not there is a legitimate argument to say, well, actually, do you know what? Top 16 teams, what have you, top 8 teams, they go through as of right anyway. Maybe link it in with the Nations League. I feel like me 10 years ago would have been saying, that's such an outrageous thing to say. But I don't know. I feel I might have softened on this particular topic. It's not because I think we're great. I just think it's because, you know, there's just no peril in it. There's no point in it. And you just wonder whether or not there's better value to be had elsewhere. That's all.
I totally see where you're coming from there. I think as well, you've got to look at these sort of games as well. How long will people be that interested in them? You've got a lot of people turning up to Villa Park, knowing that England are going to win. And you just think, well, how long will they keep on doing that? I suppose it really depends on the type of punters. But for me, I just can't see how that is that entertaining. I suppose there is the novelty value of England being in your backyard, I suppose. But yeah, and what about you, Jan? I mean, I know you're not that big on non-tournament England playing, but if they made it more competitive, like a tournament, like the Nations League, if the Nations League was something that you could really get into, do you think that would be better than wheeling teams out against Andorra? I know in the women's internationals, they've linked the Nations League to qualifying so that you don't get these ridiculous mismatches. There were horrible mismatches in the women's game. There was like 20-0 results going on. And so they've stopped that now. And all right, you don't get that in the men's game, but there was no way that Andorra were going to win that game, was there? So it was a completely pointless game to play, wasn't it?
I think so. And as well as that, I mean, football is, it's an entertainment, isn't it? You choose whether you're going to spend your time watching that to entertain you. Now, watching England against Andorra was not entertainment. And like I said, that's not just because of the result. It could have been 6-0. It still wouldn't have been entertaining because of the mismatch in the two sides and the quality of the two sides. No disrespect to Andorra, but, you know, it is what it is. So having some kind of jeopardy in there was good. I think using the Nations League for that, there's probably some legs in that. What I'd really like to see, though, is to have some kind of invitation tournament. Maybe get all the teams from the British Isles and the Republic together or do some kind of Six Nations thing. I don't know. But make it interesting, because that would be great to see. Because, you know, England playing any of the other nations on these islands would be great spectacles. They really, really would. And watching them all play each other as well would be brilliant. So even having something like that, where ordinarily you'd look at England and compare them against, I don't know, Northern Ireland, for example, you'd go, well, they're poles apart. But you put those two teams on the pitch, it's going to be a game. So something like that, I think, would be much more interesting. Far rather watch that. You could have some meaningless trophy that they could play for, but just anything to make it entertaining, because that's what it's meant to be about.
Oh, Terry, it's got to be about 15 years since we've had a Bring Back the Home Nations chat. Come on, Terry, dig in.
Bring back the home internationals. Yes, absolutely. Bring them back. Bring them back now. I have been an advocate of bringing back the home internationals for years. But if we call them the Six Nations or the Five Nations, I am burning down Wembley Stadium myself. I'm going there with the kerosene and I am burning them down, and I'm framing Jan for the crime as well. Let's try and keep the rugby union thing out of the whole thing. Let's just not do it. He does it deliberately, listeners, to trigger me.
He
chucks in rugby union references to trigger me. Conversely, rather than let's let them all in, let's make it harder for them. Let's make them play each other. Let's have a separate qualification group for all the really, really good teams to play together and then figure out the qualification from there. Not unlike the Nations League. And make it really hard for those teams to qualify. Inject a little bit of peril in it. That's really all I'm saying, is there needs to be a bit of peril in World Cup and European Championship qualifiers in order for it to be interesting, or you might as well just let them in without bothering. I guess that's my point.
I suppose really, that's what they really want to do. That's why there are so many places now available. How far do we have to expand this tournament so that Italy can qualify, for God's sake?
72 teams, Graham. 72 teams. You know what? Sod it. Everyone qualifies. Everyone's in.
You could just see FIFA was sat there thinking, oh my God, they made Gennaro Gattuso Italy manager. Oh God, they really don't want to qualify, do they? Just kidding, Gennaro. You know, I think you're great.
You're a great guy, Gennaro. Yeah, we love you.
We really do. But your weekend away, Terry, you did go and see some football, didn't you? Because although it is the international break, club football doesn't stop. Of course it doesn't, because there's non-league. But there's also women's football as well. And the new WSL season started in England at the weekend. But you were in Germany, and you went to see some Frauen-Bundesliga, didn't you?
I went to see the Frauen-Bundesliga. I went to Cologne Stadium, the Franz Kramer Stadion, which is not the big stadium that they play in. It's the smaller stadium that they play on their training complex. And Graham, you and I have been to this stadium, of course, years ago. And you'll be pleased to know it's not changed a bit. And we went there to watch a Regionalliga game between Cologne 2 and Bochum 2. Mm. So they used that stadium for their Frauen-Bundesliga side. And we watched the home side in front of, I would say, a crowd of maybe 2,000, perhaps. In fact, it says here 2,180. So that's not too bad. And lose to RB Leipzig in the blistering heat. Yes, it was a disappointing result for the home crowd. But it was a decent enough game. It was a very, very watchable game. Goals from Marlene Schwimmer and Sandra Stark. Both of whom I think are about 18 or 19. Leipzig have made a lot of changes and have brought in a few teenagers to bolster their ranks and having a bit of a change. Cologne pretty much let themselves down. They set themselves out to play with quite a low block. They've got an Icelandic international, Sandra Jessen, I think, who they've just signed, who was banging in the goals for the Icelandic league, but looked a little bit off the pace. That was a nice game and a nice way to kick off the women's football season.
Sounds it. I had a great day at the Emirates on Saturday watching Arsenal trounce the London City Lionesses 4-1. Well, trounce. The scoreline was made a little bit better in the last 10 minutes with a couple of late goals in the space of about a minute. But just short of 40,000 there at the Emirates. Not the biggest gate for women's football the weekend. I think that went to Bayern, who had an excess of 50,000 at the Allianz. But yeah, a very interesting match at the Emirates because London City Lionesses were the opponents and no one really knows what to expect from them. They've spent a lot of money. They broke the world record transfer fee on the penultimate day of the transfer window. They have signed so many players over the summer, there was absolutely no way of knowing what they were going to do. And they played a very open game. They've took the lead through a penalty, fairly won. But Arsenal got back into the game and got stronger and stronger as the game went on. And in the end, it was the use of the bench, much like England, that really made the difference in the end. All the players they brought on combined for the two goals that they scored late on in the second half. Their star players for London City Lionesses, Aslani, the Swedish international, she's 36 now. She played the entire game. When she was being used by Sweden in the Euros, she was being used for about an hour or so. When she's in a bigger squad, can do a lot more there, but she was certainly carrying a lot of the responsibility. They've got players to come in, so they may improve a bit on the performance, but I don't think it's a bad performance from London City. They won't finish bottom, I'm pretty sure of it. I'm pretty sure Leicester will finish bottom this season, but a good performance from Arsenal, though, who have been slow to start in recent seasons. So a nice win to start the season off in the sunshine. But I keep thinking about London City, and they're a side that broke away from Millwall about 6 years ago. The guy who owned them first when they split away from Millwall, they were the Millwall Lionesses. He was a blockchain entrepreneur, and he put his wife in control of the club. I don't know if they decided that it wasn't for them in the end because the money dried up and then they sold it to Michelle Kang, who owns Lyon and Angel City, the NWSL side.
It's actually Washington Spirit that she owns in the
Washington
NWSL.
Spirit, sorry, yes. But I was thinking about it because like, this is supposedly a London club, but they've never played anywhere that has a London postcode. They've played in Dartford and they now play in Bromley. Now, they have a large piece of land out near Maidstone, which was a non-league ground. Guys, do you remember K-Sports a couple of seasons ago? Whiteleaf played them. Mm. K-Sports have moved to Sheppey now, now that London City Lionesses own the plot of land. And so they've got a ground there, but they never play there. That's their training ground. They're playing in Bromley at the moment. But for me, there's no home for them. Where are they going to build a community? Or do they not bother building a community? I don't know. Terry, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know what the game plan is with that at all. It's interesting because Michelle Kang slightly tweaked the name of Olympic Lyonnais when she took over as well, or this season has. Sounds like they're trying to bring in that kind of Lionesses kind of branding together. She might look at this purely from a multi-club ownership perspective and just be looking at it from that way. But I don't think that there seems to be any attempt whatsoever to try and build any kind of community around that club. They were in Dartford, they're now in Bromley. If you don't know the London area well, they may as well be different countries in what is a very parochial city. You know, Dartford and Bromley, very, very different parts of London, of greater London, it should be said. And as Graham points out, they're not London postcodes. I don't know where they get off calling themselves a London City Lionesses, to be honest with you. It's a bit cheeky, but, you know, we shall see. And London is not a community in of itself. London is made up of a myriad of different communities, sometimes communities within communities. So I think it's very difficult what she's trying to do. And I've asked myself, she's got the money. She's clearly got the money. But, you know, where's the sustainability from it? And what does the plan look like? But I also would imagine that she's got a plan and we just don't know what that is.
What do you think, Jan? I mean, a club without a community, can that be a thing?
I don't think so. A club effectively is the community, isn't it? It's what the community rallies around. It's a big part of what people think about and what people do, and they look forward to coming together as a community to support the embodiment of that, which is the players on the pitch. So it seems a bit strange. I mean, going out to Dartford is a stretch, especially when you've got London City, which, of course, is different to London in that it's the old city. And then Bromley, Terry's right, they are very different parts of the world. They're not London at all. But going out into Kent, it was Maidstone, you said, wasn't
it? Yeah, that's where their training ground is, yeah.
Right, so, well, if their training ground's there, that's one thing. But if they were going to start basing themselves there, then you've got to look at both the London and the city part of their name. But, I mean, how far are you going to go? You know, well, I don't know. I mean, it seems like they're a nomadic club. You know, where are their supporter base going to be? You know, where are they? I mean, you know, they're not going to be around Bermondsey where they started out, are they?
That's the thing. I mean, they've obviously cut all ties away from Millwall. There is a club called Millwall Lionesses now, but I don't know how connected they are to the men's club. But there doesn't seem to be any sort of discussion about moving into London or finding a stadium. Maybe there are plans and she's just not told anyone about it. But if there's no plan to actually bring even to an existing ground, so say, for instance, if she went to, say, the Crystal Palace Sports Centre or something like that and played their home games there, or got some deal to play their matches at West Ham's ground at the London Stadium. Yeah, West Ham women can't play there because of the deal that West Ham got with Boris. That would mean renegotiating the deal, and Sadiq is not going to give them the deal that Boris did. So either they find a club which they will rent off. They will still not have a home. They'll still be tenants. I sound like I don't want a club that isn't connected to a men's team to succeed. And that is not the case. I just would prefer a club that's actually built around a community or a ground, somewhere that it can actually call its home. Because you see a lot of money going into this club and it looks like a commodity. It just looks like a brand, a franchise, rather than a club itself.
She might, and she could. She could buy Millwall. She could buy Millwall Football Club and then reintegrate the London City Lionesses back into Millwall and then move back into New Cross, into Bermondsey, and play the good matches there. And maybe if that was the game plan, then that could definitely work. I mean, the new Millwall Lionesses are the women's Millwall team. They are affiliated to Millwall Football Club. It's just that they had to start from the bottom of the pyramid when they disaffiliated, because London City Lionesses took Millwall Lionesses' place in the pyramid when they're disaffiliated. So it's possible that you might go, well, actually, I'll buy the men's team because, like, what are they going to cost? I don't know, £500,000? No? A couple of tenors, maybe? And she's well within her rounds to do it. And it would fit in with this whole Lions thing that she's got going on. So maybe that is the plan. She's just waiting her moment. But I can't see them staying in Bromley for any length of time. And yeah, I mean, there's no possibility of finding. I mean, I know she's rich, but my goodness, to carve out some real estate in central London, particularly in the city of London, impossible, I'd say.
Yeah.
Impossible. Certainly north of the river, maybe south of the river, but even then, that's a stretch.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But worthwhile watching to see what happens. It does feel like a football experiment at the moment, and I just wonder how we'd feel if this was the men's team doing this.
Appalled.
Yeah, I think that would...
Absolutely appalled.
Yeah.
It would be an abomination. Yeah, absolutely. But they're getting off the hook because it's the women's team. I mean, I personally think that the women's game should be completely disaffiliated from the men's team.
Yeah.
I think the women's game won't genuinely flourish until it's free and clear of the men's game. But I appreciate that that is a process that needs to go through. You can't just do that straight away. And this is not the way. But because it's women's football and because I'm not minded to be appalled by it, I am not. But yeah, I mean, this is worse than Milton Keynes, right? Arguably.
I think it's on a parallel with that. I do. I mean, there are parallels in the names there, aren't there?
That's what she's going to do. She's going to move everything to Milton Keynes.
Well, at least they've got a ground.
Milton
then.
Keynes Lions. Yeah, that's true. They will have a little, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be a hockey stadium, but it will be a ground. Some of the finest clubs in the country were created just to fill a ground up. Palace,
yeah,
Liverpool, Palace. Chelsea, all of them. Well, all right, Chelsea's not one of the finest clubs, all right, but I'm just using it for a point.
They're a really awful football club.
They're
Chelsea.
A really awful football club.
They are really awful.
They are an awful
as a football club.
Yes,
awful.
Yeah, so it's a fine tradition of that, but this isn't doing that. This is another thing. This is basically creating a club to fill a franchise. I think that, yeah, if it was happening in the men's game, there would be uproar, I feel anyway. But anyway, we'll see how this pans out. I'll be interested to see what happens. And anyway, we beat them 4-1, and the crowd were chanting, same old Millwall, always cheating. So I was very, very, very pleased about that. Yeah, are you Millwall in disguise? Yes, you are. You are just Millwall in disguise. As long as we keep remembering that, yeah, we know who they are. We know who they are.
Poor old Millwall.
Can't play for football. yes. What it did mean was that we didn't have any Tottenham chants at the Emirates at the weekend, which is always nice. If Tottenham aren't playing, why are we chanting about them? But there has been some big news with Tottenham this week, hasn't there, Jan? Ground-shaking news.
It's ground-shaking news. Yeah, long-time executive chairman, Daniel Levy, who came in with the new ownership 24 years ago, is stepping down from his role. Still quite a sizable shareholder, but certainly he is not going to be in his role anymore, which was huge news. Some of his critics would say that he effectively made Spurs Spursy. But I think there's a balance to this story. I don't think it's necessarily all bad under his tenure. Spurs have improved in terms of the things like their average league position compared to before, you know, the 10 years before he was there. They've got a world-class stadium, world-class infrastructure, but they haven't really achieved much other than the fact that they are a powerhouse of a financial institution, if you like, within the Premier League, but only got a couple of trophies to show for his time there. Yeah, so he's stepping aside. Cue lots of wondering about what's going to happen next. Lots of speculation. Is the club going to get sold? I'm sure we can talk about that across this little section.
Well, yeah. There's lots of speculation because people were caught on the hop by it. Usually there's rumours or someone in the know. And considering there are lots and lots of journalists who fancy themselves as being quite close to the club, that they would have felt that they knew something like this was coming up. And everyone who I know who writes about Tottenham was completely sideswiped by this. So it does make me think whether or not it was a quick decision, whether or not it was a decision by Levy himself. He's 63 now. You know, he might be coming to a stage where he actually thinks, well, look, I don't need to do this anymore. I've got all of the money. So do I need to put up with this anymore? And probably have a good enough reason to say, look, I've done this for 25 years. I want something else. Terry, it's difficult to know whether or not this is going to be an improvement for Spurs or not, because we don't know how much of Spurs over the last 25 years was entirely down to Levy's management. Things could get worse without his hand on the wheel. What's your gut feeling about the whole thing?
I think it's possible that he was actually kind of fired, that there was a review and that it was fired. It's just the timing is odd at the beginning of the season. It might well be it was like, you are Daniel, we're going to make a change. And he was gone, what if it's all the same to you? I'll go now. And this is a familiar conversation that people have when they're being laid off. It's like, well, if it's all the same to you, I'll sod off now then. He has taken an awful lot of grief down the years. And if it was the case that, and is the case that the ownership is looking to make a change, then who could blame him for saying, well, look, I don't think I've earned the right to not do a full handover and just sod off now if it's all the same to you. Because I think he's taken enough. He's earned it. He's made his money. He can spend a great deal of time counting his money that he's made. And it's all fine. I'm not feeling sorry for him. From a business point of view, from growing the club, I'd have to say he has been a successful chairman. Mm. Now, he has overseen the transition to a new stadium, made that happen. Moving, we're talking about the London City Lionesses and about how absurd it would be, the idea of them finding a stadium in London. To move your stadium a few hundred yards along and make it a brand new stadium under those circumstances is incredibly difficult. It's very expensive. It requires an awful lot of cutting through red tape, a lot of consultation, probably a lot of arm twisting. It was the same deal when Arsenal moved from Highbury to the Emirates, just round the corner. Incredibly difficult to carve out that much real estate in central London and make it stick. That in itself is a lifetime's work. If that is his legacy, then it's an achievement in of itself. And I understand it is a magnificent stadium, even if you do want to occasionally poke fun of it. But I think most people would agree that it's a fine example of a modern stadium. It actually looks like a decent stadium. It's not a kind of out-of-the-box brand new stadium. It looks like a decent stadium. And it's a remarkable achievement to be able to pull off something like that. Years and years and hard work and seeing that all through. And I don't think you can or should take that away. And not everybody can do that. You look at what Steve Parish has been trying to get the stand, the main stand replaced at Selhurst Park, 5-6 years now. He still can't pull it off. So these things are not easy to do. And Daniel Levy was able to do that. I think the club has grown. It's grown in revenue. It's grown in stature in his time there. Part of this is because of the development and the growth of the Premier League and Tottenham being able to sort of benefit from that. But you could argue he's put them in a position where they're well placed to do that. They're one of the best supported teams, I would suggest, in the world and one of the richest football clubs in the world. It's just on the sporting side where there's a deficit. Two trophies in the time that he's been there. That's not really very good for a club of that size and stature. With the players that have come through their doors, with the managers that have come through their doors, you would expect to see a bit more. Should it really have been his job to do that kind of thing? He was a bit of an old school chairman who was also acting like a bit of a sports director. Where in fact, where he fell short was he didn't bring about a team around him that could do the sports stuff better than he can. And maybe see if they could have won a few more football matches and won a few more trophies.
I guess the timing of it signifies how much input he had into signings. And maybe that's where the problems came from. For him to go immediately after the transfer window closes, where they've had a pretty poor transfer window in comparison to their main rivals, that says to me why he's been moved on. I think that perhaps that there is a feeling that he has not been as good in the transfer market. But I think you're right, Terry. I think they have got the finest NFL stadium outside of the US. I'm an Arsenal fan. You can't expect me not to have little tiny, tiny digs wherever I can here. But as far as chairmen go, there are much, much worse chairmen to have than Daniel Levy. To leave it in the state that he has is a lot better than a lot of other chairmen. So I wonder how much it will change. Peter Carrington is the new chairman. I don't know what his experience of football is, but I think perhaps he'll bring in a team of sporting directors to help out with all that stuff and just maintain the business side of it.
Yeah, his appointment, and there's been a few other high profile, there's a new CEO come in as well. And the Lewis family, I'm not quite sure the time frame on this, but certainly a few months ago, they brought in a big consultancy to do a kind of root and branch. Why are we not as successful as we'd like to be given the foundations that we've got? And I'm wondering whether the response or the report that came back on that to the Lewis family was that something needs to change. I completely agree with your assessment, both of you, about that stadium, and that will be his legacy. That thing is like a cathedral. It's incredible. And you know, he should be very proud of what he's achieved there. But just a point on the number of managers and the number of players that have been through there. I read a brief interview with Martin Yall, who was the Spurs coach, if you remember, back in 2007-ish, around that time. And he had quite a balanced view on Levy when he said, there's no doubt the guy's an incredible businessman and he knows business inside out. He said, but he surrounded himself sometimes with the wrong people and he made some scattergun decisions in terms of recruitment. And he went on to point out one particular example where they missed out on Luis Suarez when Levy was advised that he just wasn't worth it. And obviously he went on to be and continues to be a world-class player. It's a good time, I think, for someone like Thomas Frank, who I think is rightfully highly rated as a coach. I worried that he'd made the wrong decision going to Spurs, but I think that if there's been a change, and that's going to allow Thomas Frank to kind of spread his wings and do something decent, which he, you know, I really want him to do because he comes across as such a lovely guy. And as well as that, he really knows his shit. So hopefully this will allow him to achieve something. I know Graham probably isn't what you want him to do, but I think it'll be good for football and for the Premier League, for English football to have a lot more competition there. And I think Thomas Frank being at the head of that with a new revitalised backroom team, if you like, or a boardroom team, will enable him to fly, really. So, yeah. Interesting times coming up for Spurs.
Yeah. I know it's easy to say, oh, they haven't achieved much. But Terry, as a fan of a middle-class club of the Premier League, you've still got to look at Tottenham and think, well, look, they're better than us over seasons. Last season was a blip, but they are a team that are in the way of you and getting further success, isn't it?
I would characterise Tottenham Hotspur traditionally as being a top six club.
Yeah.
With aspirations to being a top four club, and you know, legitimate aspirations of being a top four club, given the club's resources. This is a club that should certainly be participating in the Champions League on a regular basis through the league route by finishing in the top four. It's very congested up there, that top six, yeah. Top seven. There's quite a few clubs that could legitimately play and compete in the Champions League and finish in the top four. So it's not a guaranteed thing. But I think that it is probably reasonable to say that they've fallen short in that area. And there was a big thing, particularly during the Poch era, like, oh, he never won a trophy. Winning trophies is hard. Mm. Winning finals is hard. Getting to finals is hard. They're one-off football matches for the most part. Easy games to lose. So I always thought that was a little bit unkind. But I guess the point is to what extent are Tottenham in the conversation about these kind of honours? And you feel that they weren't in that conversation as often as perhaps they should be. And I think then this is where the Spursy thing comes in. And Tottenham fans have a particular narrative about themselves, which they seek a great deal of comfort from when they're, you know, facing up to the disappointments that they're not quite, you know, where they want to be by comparison to their own expectations or by comparison to, say, Arsenal, about where they would like to be. And that then leans into this idea that they're somewhat haphazard, that they're somewhat chaotic, that they shoot themselves in the foot, which is, I guess, is probably kind of true. But to what extent this really could be laid at the chairman's door, I'm not sure. Beyond the fact, as Jan points out, he made transfer decisions that maybe were questionable, but also the fact that he made transfer decisions at all, because he was well known. Mm. I mean, a lot of people only really knew him for some of the big grandstanding sort of like moments in the transfer window back in the halcyon days when journalists were allowed into the training grounds on deadline day. And deadline day was this massive, massive circus. Players in new club car parks waiting to be transferred. And a lot of that narrative about transfer deadline day was down to Levy, specifically the Berbatov transfer and the Modric transfer, both of which were real, like, cliffhangers. And Levy is kind of associated with that because, you know, he pushed and pushed and pushed to get the best deal that he could. But really, there is an argument to say, well, look, I'm sorry, chum, this shouldn't be your concern. You should have people in charge of that, doing that yourself, because you can't do it all. Now, being a football guy, even back then, was hard in order, and while at the same time being a club chairman. And nowadays, of course, it's completely out of the question. The scope of both your tasks is too wide that you can't be good at either of them. And I think that that's possibly where he fell down, was that he didn't recognise that the job was too big and that maybe other people did recognise that and said, well, this has been a rubbish transfer. You know, you're the guy in charge of transfers. Why aren't you making other people responsible for this? Hire a sporting director, they do have them, but hire a sporting director who is actually responsible for this. Give them, that person, the budget and tell them to get on with it, and then you hold them to account if they don't get it right. But in fact, what's happening is that he's taking responsibility, was taking responsibility, I think, for too much. And then I think it's led to his kind of downfall. And as you say, I mean, I think in a few months' time, a few years' time, all of that will be forgotten. I think he'll be remembered with a degree of kindness for the achievements that he did bring to the club. And he'll be fine. He'll be happy. I mean, 63 years old, he's still got plenty of life ahead of him. Still got plenty of life ahead of him. Plenty of opportunities for him to enjoy his money and maybe seek a new challenge.
The expectations at Tottenham, although you think, well, like they are a top six side, and they are a top six side. They're one of the biggest teams in the country. But when he came into the club, it was the big four. And during his tenure, Chelsea have been moneyed. Man City have been moneyed. And so everyone in that top echelon felt the need to jostle around and go down a level. There was no two ways about it. And so I think it was difficult enough for clubs like Arsenal, like Man United, like Liverpool. But at least they'd won championships in people's lifetimes. For a club like Tottenham, they were good in cups. But having two teams come through that were starting to win everything, it suddenly made winning something a lot harder. Arsenal went long periods without winning stuff. They've in a period of 5 years without winning stuff right now. And they've got a really good team right now. So, yeah, if things are going to change at Tottenham, it's not going to be quick. But I'm with you, Jan. I think Thomas Frank is a good fit there. And hopefully he will remain a good fit. Hopefully the new guy comes in, even if he brings a team of sporting directors and people to try and build up a new Tottenham sporting mentality or ethos, that means that Thomas Frank is somehow built in with that. You kind of hope so, but who knows? Interesting times ahead, you think. But the interesting times start this weekend, don't they? When club football returns. Yes, the international break comes to an end and club football finally comes back. And Tottenham have got... you would have said this would actually be quite a comfortable game for them to come back to after the international break at home to West Ham. But West Ham had a good win the last time out, didn't they, Ian? And Tottenham didn't. Tottenham lost their last game for the international break. So what do you think that was going to go like?
It's going to be an interesting one. I don't think West Ham are as bad as their start suggested. Should be a good one. Yeah, looking forward to that one.
That's the battle to see who's the third best team in London, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, behind... what shall we say, Graham? never mind London, Graham. What about Manchester?
Well, yes, there is the Manchester Derby on Sunday. Last season, both of these Derby games were comedy events, weren't they? Is it going to be a comedy event this time around?
It's possible. It's just possible because both teams really do look like they could use a bit of an enema, don't they? They are they're not enjoying the happiest of form. I mean, we're used to it with Manchester United, but it's still a bit weird with Manchester City. They started the season really, really well, or that is to say their first game went really, really well. But after that, it's all gone a bit weird for City. So who knows what's going to be happening with that game? There could be hijinks involved. I mean, it's a derby. There's bound to be hijinks, but it could really be high hijinks.
You are covering that along with Leverkusen post Erik ten Hag against Eintracht on Friday night. There's plenty to watch, and all of these games will be in our weekend box set. And if you want to see what we think of the seven games we think you should be watching between Friday and Sunday, then get along to sofpodcast.com, click on the link for the weekend box set, and subscribe. Or go to Substack and find it there. Weekend box set by The Sound of Football. But that is all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeVellin, it's goodbye.
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 Get in touch with us on Blue Sky or Instagram, where we are at Sound of Football, or go to sofpodcast.com. Like us, share us, rate us, and review us. Do it now!
Yes, the image quality on your new camera is banging. You look really clear. Yeah, it's putting mine to shame, actually. I look a bit fuzzy, but I think that's because my son seems to... this is a family computer. And I think every time he gets on it, he goes and finds like a tub of lard, puts his thumb in it, and just smears it across the camera. I think that's his standard routine.
I think that's what the teens do, isn't it, these days?
I think that's what they do, Graham. Yeah.